Thank you, Madam Moderator, and I'm very honored to be here to address you all this August gathering. Indeed, I'll be talking about perspective. In fact, the perspective of provincializing Europe and the very expression provincializing Europe was not mine, was Hans-Georg Gadamer's. There is a profound conversation that I'll touch on going on in the world between what I represent, post-colonial thinking and German thought. And I stand here as actually a beneficiary not only of German thought, but also German institutions. I've been formally and informally involved with many institutions here, many conversations here, which have all been extremely productive for my own thinking. I believe talking about three, I have some slides, and I don't know how, do the slides go on this queue? Okay. Just.
Not the one that looks like a star.
Oh, this one here.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's good. Okay. So, how do you go back?
With the red, the tiny red one.
The tiny red one. No. Okay. Maybe I'll start. It did go back. Okay. So I do want to talk about humanities, and I think humanities have an extremely important role to play, not just with globalization questions, but actually with the current planetary problems of the world, the environmental problems. And the interesting thing is, you see it in the very expression, dangerous climate change. So while climate change is a problem that can be defined mainly by climate scientists, the word dangerous cannot be defined by science alone. Because danger involves defining what we value. I mean, dangerous to what? I mean, if human beings go, it's not a danger to the planet. So when you say it's dangerous, climate change, you mean dangerous for human beings, and therefore it raises the question of what do human beings value? So in a sense, the humanities question is there right from the beginning in treating climate issue as a problem to be dealt with. But there is also, I think, at the same time I want to argue, a need for a change of gear, a shift in perspectives as you move from the story of globalization, these are all stories we tell ourselves, to the story of climate change or planetary problems like water scarcity, food security. And the reason is mainly that when you speak of globalization and global issues, voices from the south, voices from the north, globalization is essentially a story focused on human beings. It's a very anthropocentric or homocentric story. The environmental crisis, on the other hand, is a story about human beings plus other entities on the planet. And in that sense, I'm very pleased that a lot of what I have to say is really an elaboration of what you, Professor Legui, said in your welcoming remarks. In that sense, I'm touching on many of the issues that you touched on, probably elaborate on them. And thirdly, having emphasized this distinction, I will speak a little bit about the implications for change of perspectives that these two issues kind of called for. And a change of perspectives is not in an either-or sense. Now, I'm not talking about intersection of two sets. I'm actually talking about the union of two sets. So in the sense of doing both at the same time, just being able to shift gears. So as you know, globalization and global issues of diversity, the big one should, again, I had the same problem, okay. I'll come to this topic, so don't look at the board, look at the projection yet. The global issues of diversity, cosmopolitanism, universalism, these are, the way the questions have been framed, I think, has produced actually a global conversation between what I take to be a tradition of German thinking, translated into many other languages, and thoughts coming out of the non-Western world. And what I mean by German thinking is a line of 20th century thinkers from Heidegger, Karl Jaspers, Carl Schmitt, Hannah Arendt, Gadamer himself, many of these thinkers were actually worried that a world that the European empires had brought together would ultimately be united by technology alone, including Adorno. So you can think of the fear of mass culture, mass society. So the fear, the deep-seated fear that the German thinkers had was that technology would unite the world, but at the expense of cultural diversity. And the world would become uniform. Jaspers was even critical of films, Hollywood, saying that you see Hollywood films and you see them all dancing the same dances. And you can think of issues of multiculturalism. You can think of a writer like Salman Rushdie, for instance, or Turkish novelists writing in Germany, or Turkish filmmakers making films here, or the kind of cultures that that the Keita Humberger Centers are trying to promote as actually a response to that line of thinking, which was fearful that a technologically united world will be culturally uniform. In many respects, I think the globalization discussion, which has been about inequity in the world, about hearing multiple voices being audible, has also been actually about answering this question in the affirmative, saying that just because there's mass culture, just because there's mass technology, just because that there's mass production, it does not mean that we all become ironed into some kind of uniformity. That in spite of these technologies producing the connectivity of the world, there's still a capacity in human beings to express difference, to appreciate difference, and to enrich ourselves from those differences. Now, in an essay that he wrote in 1983, Gadamer, in an essay, I think it's called The Legacy of Europe, or What Does European Thought Mean, something on those lines, Gadamer was somewhat desperately on this question and thinking what would ensure that the world did not become uniform. And one of his hopes was the institution called the university. He said, okay, European knowledges have become knowledge forms for all parts of the people. You know, everybody has the same kind of syllabus in teaching political science or physics or anthropology. You teach the same people. But he thought that maybe the form of the knowledge will remain European, but the content will be diverse. So that eventually, by using European knowledge, the Chinese will still feel Chinese, the Indians will still feel Indians. And there are two problems that Gadamer didn't think about in thinking thus. Though I think he was totally right in terms of formation of the university as a European institution and the spread of it. The two things he didn't think about, it seems to me, are precisely one, that he did not think about diversity within these cultures. So there may not be any one way of feeling Indian, any one way of feeling Chinese. You only have to ask people from Tibet to get an answer to this question. And similarly, he did not think that actually incorporating even these knowledge forms, and I'm not talking about the content, into other places would require translation. In India, for instance, people still debate whether the Sanskrit word itihasa, which we use for history, does mean what Westerners may have meant by history. We still debate whether the word darshan does mean what Westerners mean by philosophy. We still debate whether the word dharma does mean what Westerners mean by religion. So while we use these words and we have these departments, the debates about translations go on. And in a sense, what Gadamer didn't foresee was that a lot of the discussion about globalization would actually be discussions that gave a privileged place to the question of actual metaphorical institutional translation. And Gerald Delanty, the professor of sociology at Sussex, recently wrote a very interesting essay actually showing how the translation question eventually even translates basic categories. So he says there's a project for the word cosmopolitan to be cosmopolitanized. In other words, to be translated back into other traditions of cosmopolitanism. And there's an interesting point to be made here, which I think goes back to the question that you were asking, Mr. Lewig, but also something that Joachim Nettelbeck raised this morning in informal conversations, hearing the voices of the South. And the question is this. that in today's world, thinking about globalization, we cannot proceed ignoring what happens in places like India and China. Because between them, India and China has almost 40% of the world's population, about 37% of the world population. And the question of a global conversation is actually a question of building institutions, building institutional capacities in these countries. And that cannot simply be done by extending, you know, a Max Weber Institute into Delhi or a German Historical Research Institute in Mumbai or in Dhaka. It actually involves building, and I'm talking about humanities, building the capacity for humanities research, humanities thinking in these countries. I can speak for India. I don't know enough about China, but in India, in Chicago, in my department of South Asian studies, we teach 11 South Asian languages, up to PhD level, from undergraduate to PhD level. When we try to recruit people to teach these languages, we don't find them in South Asia. Most our Bengali professor is a Frenchman. Our Hindi professor is a German scholar. Our Tamil professor is a German scholar. So actually, it's Europe and North America which have retained, for all the funding cuts and crisis, the capacity to produce deep scholarship in the humanities. And I'm talking about in Sanskrit, in Bengali, in Gujarati, in all of these things. And therefore, there's a very critical question of the role that these countries have to play. And there's a question of cooperating with these countries, not by simply exporting European institutions to these countries, but by actually helping these countries to build capacities. And there are different models for this. The University of Chicago has just actually opened a center in Delhi, a center in Beijing, and we're trying to open a center in Rio to engage in these capacities because, you know, this conversation always reminds me of a point that the great African leader Leopold Senghor used to make in the 50s, where he used to dream of a global humanities that was genuinely plural, that will actually bring deep humanities thinking from other places, which cannot happen in the absence of institution building in these countries, in the humanities. If you want to go and talk to the Indian government about building a medical science institute, immediately they'll say yes. A science institute, yes. But a humanities institute? An institute for philology? No, but we need an Indian Institute of Philological Research, like the Indian Institute of Technology. We don't have those things. And that, I think, impacts on the process, Joachim, that you mentioned this morning. From there, let me go on to my second theme, hoping that... Okay. Actually, about the issues of planetary proportions. Now, interestingly, as I said, the globalization story connects up with the global warming story, at least in some of the hypotheses being put forward now. And some environmental scientists, including a historian, John McNeill, an environmental historian, as you know, some of them have put together this great acceleration thesis, which is that this is the index of human activity in different areas in the world. And you can see how the exponential growth comes after 1950. So even when we blame the Industrial Revolution and all of these things for carbon emissions, really, the entire world accelerates. And that's the population increase. So the world has actually seen almost three times the growth on population, 2.5 times. In India, it's grown four times in the last 66 years or so. The world is getting urbanized. By the end of the century, Michael Davis, the Los Angeles academician, has described it as a planet of slums. And actually, urbanization makes the environmental problems more acute. But at the same time, it has implications for democracies. More power needs to go to the cities, actually, if this has to be managed. And this is primary energy use. And somewhere here, if you can imagine the 1970s, the OPEC crisis, when we thought we had a big crisis in oil supply, you can see it didn't even make a dent. And that's the primary energy. And primary energy is the energy you use before actually converting it into purified fuel and stuff. And that is the impact we're having on the planet, on the environment. post-1950s mostly. So it's clear that we need to collaborate. The global planetary problems call for global action, but it doesn't mean that we have stopped our conflicts. And the Israelis and the Palestinians don't have to be told that they're the same species. The knowledge doesn't stop people from fighting each other. And that's a very popular map. I think you know it. But this idea that we have to work together is producing, of course, a hypothesis that Professor Legge mentioned about planetary boundaries. This is scientists getting together trying to show the leeway that human beings have with respect to water use, land systems change. You know, the green is the area of safety, and it shows the red is the area of danger. Yellow is sort of, you know, quasi-dangerous, and it shows where we are as a species. This, in spite of an unjust world, in spite of 2 billion people living without access to fresh water, in spite of the consuming classes perhaps being about around 3 billion, in spite of Thomas Piketty's argument about growing inequality in the world. So if you imagine all of us, 7 to 11 billion people living better than we live now, even on an average, it's going to have great implications for that kind of structure. And therefore, there's clearly a question of how do we think about being together? How do we think about global human action together? But as I said, the globalization story was a homocentric story. But the planetary crisis story, the global warming story, even though they intersect in the Great Acceleration thesis, the planetary crisis story is not just a homocentric story. It is actually about human beings and non-human beings, both animate and inanimate. And that, I think, produces certain challenges to our imagination. So I'll just end by... So the problem here is actually, if I put another constraint before you, so if you believe in what we believe in since the Second World War, the very idea of human rights is based on the idea of valuing human life. So if you actually believe in sustaining 7 to 11 billion people on the planet with some respect for their lives, we cannot do without modern technologies. In fact, a Duke University geologist, Peter Half, has produced an extremely interesting speculative idea. It sometimes reminds me of Nicholas Luhmann, even though he's a geologist thinking like this, of the technosphere, where he actually argues that you cannot if it's true that you cannot sustain 7 to 11 billion people without modern connectivity and modern technology, then technology has become the next biology. And therefore, he thinks that apart from atmosphere, stratosphere, biosphere, we should also introduce the concept of a technosphere, of which he thinks we are the sentient parts. And therefore, the idea of even a Gandhian-like idea that you can decentralize economy, you can give up modern technology, you can go back to backyard gardens and backyard gardening, he's arguing that we are at a point of no return with respect to those thoughts. If you believe in sustaining the number of people and sustaining them well, that is 7 to 11 billion people. So then that actually leads me to the question of two perspectives. As I said, the homocentric perspective, which is you tell the story of humans alone, which is what globalization stories are. There is no globalization story without humans at the center of it. North, south, east, west, other people's voices, self and the other, all of those dialectic. And that I will call a homocentric point of view. What I think the planetary crisis calls for in the humanities is a different kind of perspective, and I'm not saying they're either or, we have to do them together, which I will call not biocentric because of the way the word bios has been used by Foucault and Agamben and even Hannah Arendt, who basically made a distinction in their reading of Aristotle to say that bios referred to life in the city, that is human lives. But zoe refers to generally reproductive life, life in general. So I'll call it a zoe-centric point of view. Homocentric and a zoocentric point of view. So these are the two forms of thinking that I'm talking about. And I think these forms of thinking have been with us, both, you know, for a long time, from this the Blue Marble planet picture, 1972, as well as the Earthrise picture, slightly older, 1968. And I'll just simply give you some examples to show how they were both there. Immediate responses to the sight of the Earth, this one, seen from space, evoked thoughts about human dwelling, on the one hand. Astronauts spontaneously expressing the hope that Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, Arthur Clarke, the science fiction writer who was in turn influenced by Toynbee, and others had articulated in the 1950s, that is, the thought that humanity might now see the whole Earth as their home, bringing an end to all nationalist and other ideological strifes. Alongside these reactions, which I'm calling homocentric, there were also reactions that focused on life as such. The microbiologist René Dubos remarked, looking at this picture, how drab and gray, unappealing and insignificant this planet would be without the radiance of life, because it's the only planet with color, at least for the space voyagers. The rest is all darkness and bright spots. Both of these views were co-present, for instance, in what the American modernist poet and the librarian of the Congress, Archibald MacLeish, wrote famously on December 25, 1968, in immediate response to the picture of Earthrise. His prose poem, called Riders on Earth Together, Brothers in Eternal Cold, was pregnant with the tension between homocentric and what I'm calling zoocentric views of the place of humans on the planet. And just to give you a taste of the difference, I'm reading out a homocentric line from the poem, where he says, to see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful, in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the Earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know they are truly brothers. That's the homocentric form of thinking at its noblest. At the same time, there are lines that I would regard as zoocentric. For example, for the first time in all of time, men have seen whole and round and beautiful and small as even Dante had never dreamed of seeing it, as the 20th century philosophers of absurdity and despair were incapable of guessing that it might be seen. And seeing it, one question came to the minds of those who looked at it. Is it inhabited? They said to each other and laughed. And then they did not laugh. What came to their minds 100,000 miles and more into space, halfway to the moon, as they put it, what came to their minds was life on that little, lonely, floating planet, the tiny raft in the enormous empty night. Is it inhabited? Indeed, for those of you who engage with the climate literature will know that why the planet is life-friendly, the question of the habitability of the planet is one of the basic questions that actually come up in discussions of climate change. Now, the challenge then is actually how we stretch our ideas of politics and justice to beyond human beings. We can't do it. There's a very interesting book called Atmospheric Justice by an American academic called Steve Vanderheiden, who's a Rawlsian. And if you read the book, it's very interesting to see what happens in the book. He begins by acknowledging that the atmosphere is shared not just between humans. It's actually shared between humans and many other animals, the plants, and many, many other entities. But when it comes to actually thinking about justice in a Rawlsian fashion, he realizes that the Rawlsian idea of justice, which is probably one of the highest exposition of a liberal theory of justice, cannot be extended to non-human beings. So in the end, eventually he says that I acknowledge that atmospheric justice actually requires justice to be done, not just to humans, but I will speak of humans alone. And I don't blame him because, you know, if you read the works of Latour, Philip Descola, the Brazilian anthropologist, Viveiros de Castro, a lot of people, Jane Bennett in America, are trying now experimentally to think their way towards another world in which humans can share the question of justice with non-humans. As you know, Ecuador and some places have given rights to ponds and things, but in the Rawlsian formulation, he says quite rightly that if in our parliament you appoint spokespeople for fish or for rocks, you will only produce a legislative minority. Our idea of democracy cannot handle this question. So I don't think I have an answer to the question, but I think I know where the challenge is. And I read Latour and Descola and all these thinkers as responding to the challenge. You also see where the problem is. So if you read Latour's Politics of Nature or Modes of Existence, this book, you'll always find that he's trying to think his way towards something that is so foreign to our thinking that he has to produce a dictionary alongside the book. So he has to produce a huge glossary. And he has to produce a huge number of acronyms. It's almost like you have to go through a bureaucracy before you can reach his imagination, because bureaucracies are entities that specialize in producing acronyms. But I'm not criticizing him. I'm simply saying the challenge is so great. And his books are timely recognition of the challenge. Then it's not necessarily the answers to the challenges. But I want to end by saying that the story of globalization still remains with us. The story of injustice between human beings, the inequalities that we are all sensitive to, the inequalities that actually the Cato Hamburger College, the centers are trying to address, are all with us. So, as I said, these are not either-or perspectives. But alongside the question of globalization has emerged the question of global warming. And you cannot think about global warming simply through globalization framework, because then you come back only to questions of human justice and justice between humans, while clearly it calls for justice between humans and non-humans, wherever you look at it. And for that, you need to think in a different way. And that's why I was saying that these are not either-or questions. These are a question of trying to think on different scales from different perspectives at the same time. Thank you very, very much.
Professor Chakravarti, thank you so much for letting us in onto these thoughts, especially on science fiction. I could continue That's talking true. To you That's about that the whole day. There's one question that remains. I've introduced you as somebody who is wandering between the worlds. Is there a home? Is there a center for you personally?
Can I also answer the question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I did mean to say, actually, it comes back to, again, something that you brought up, Professor Legui, which is the real question for all of us, and I'll come back to the question of home. The real question is, how do we think about these different perspectives and keep a sense of democracy alive? In other words, make sure that the solution to the climate problem is not merely technological. A merely technological solution, geoengineering, will also become undemocratic. And that requires, actually, a middle ground between academic discussions and public discussions. And my own, something where I said I've been a beneficiary of German institutions, but also European institutions, I thought the exhibition that the House of World Cultures did on Anthropocene and the project they carried out, in which I participated, the exhibition that the Rachel Carson Center organized, and I've just come here from the Center for Contemporary Culture in Barcelona, where apart from talking about climate change, they also had a fascinating exhibition on Siebold and his writings. I actually think we need these kind of public spaces. So when I talk about institution building in places like India and China, it doesn't mean just academic institutions. It actually means building these middle ground institutions. And that happens to some degree in Europe. It doesn't happen in America, North America, for reasons we know. And Europe is one place where it does happen. And I think there's something to be generalized from that, and you'll, of course, come across resistance. I mean, I participated in a big conference in China where we were allowed to speak absolutely freely, provided we stayed on the fifth floor of the Art Institute in Shanghai and didn't advertise except through email. And you had to go to the fifth floor to finally find the poster. Now, clearly, that's an avoidance of the middle ground. That's an avoidance of creating that kind of stuff. Where is home? Home really depends on how you think about it. And there's one distinction I make about it, is that very few human beings are rooted. So when Lady Diana was killed, I asked my class, when I read that her body was going to be buried in the place where her family reportedly had stayed for 500 years, I asked my class I was in Australia then, I think. I asked my class in Melbourne, how many of you can say that your families have stayed in the same place for 500 years? Now, of course, in Australia, the answer was given because Europeans had only been there for 200 years, so, and most of my students were of European descent, and otherwise they were migrants, so there was nobody. But anywhere, I mean, even in this audience, I think very few people will say, my family has stayed in this place for 500, which shows human beings are seldom rooted, but they dwell. Dwelling means that when you go to a new place, you find out from other people how people live there and have lived there. So dwelling means a recognition in any place that other people have been there before you, and they have left traces in language, in poetry, in art, in their way of living for other people as to how to live there. So Australian settlement is impossible to imagine without knowing Aboriginal history and where the Aboriginal people lived, because they knew where the water was. They knew where the land was fertile and led Europeans to those places. So for me, dwelling is the question of being at home, which means this question, do I know enough about how people have lived here in order to feel at home in this place? And in that sense, home isn't more than one place. Thank you.
Thank you so much.